their choice, was based more on political reasons than military ones. New England leaders figured that putting a Virginian in charge would increase the enthusiasm of the Southern colonies to fight. The Southern leaders agreed, and it didn't hurt that, being quite wealthy, Washington could dig into his own wallet when it got tough to finance the fighting. For his part, Washington wasn't so sure he was up to the task. "I declare with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with," he told Congress, and then refused to take any salary for the job. Finding faults in George. Washington had his flaws. He wasn't a military genius, and he lost a lot more than he won on the battlefield. In fact, his greatest military gifts were in organizing retreats and avoiding devastating losses. He had no discernible sense of humor and was a snob when it came to mixing with what he considered the lower classes. He also had a terrible temper. Disgusted with the lack of discipline and acts of cowardice in the American army, he unsuccessfully asked Congress to increase the allowable number of lashes for punishing soldiers from 39 to 500. Once, he was so angry at a subordinate, he broke his personal rule against swearing. "He swore that day till the leaves shook on the trees," recalled an admiring onlooker. "Charming, delightful. Sir, on that memorable day, he swore like an angel from heaven." Commanding a country. In spite of his flaws, Washington was a born leader, one of those men who raised spirits and expectations simply by showing up. He was tall and athletic, an expert horseman, and a good dancer. He wasn't particularly handsome. His teeth were bad, and he wasn't proud of his hippopotamus ivory and gold dentures, so he seldom smiled. But he had a commanding presence, and his troops felt they could depend on him. He was also a bit of an actor. Once, while reading something to his troops, he donned his spectacles and then apologized, explaining his eyes had grown dim in the service of his country. Some of his audience wept. His spirit was indomitable. His army was ragged, undisciplined, and undependable, with a staggering average desertion rate of 20%. His bosses in Congress were often indecisive, quarrelsome, and indifferent. But Washington refused to give up. Just as important, he refused the temptation to try to become a military dictator, which he may easily have done. One of the reasons men loved him was that Washington was personally brave, often on the battle's front lines, and always among the last to retreat. He was also very lucky. In one battle, Washington rode unexpectedly into a group of British soldiers, most of whom fired at him at short range. They all missed. Declaring independence. Despite the fact that fighting had actually started, many in the Continental Congress and throughout the colonies still weren't all that keen on breaking away completely from Britain. The radicals, who were ready for a break, needed a spark to light a fire under those who were still reluctant to act. Not only did they get the spark they needed, but they also got it in writing with the Declaration of Independence. Stirring up colonists' emotions. The first motivator was a political blunder by the British government. The Brits needed more fighters, but British citizens didn't fall all over themselves trying to sign up. Being a British soldier often meant brutal treatment, poor pay and food, and the chance that someone would kill you. So, British officials hired the services of soldiers who worked for a half-dozen German princes. Eventually, they rented about 30,000 of these Hessians, named after the principality of Hesse Castle, from which many of them came. The Americans were outraged at this. It was one thing for the mother country and her daughters to fight, but it was a real affront for Mom to go out and hire foreigners to do her killing for her. Eventually, about 12,000 Hessians deserted and remained after the war as citizens of the new country. The second spark came from the pen of a 38-year-old tomato-faced Englishman with a big nose. Thomas Paine arrived in the colonies in November 1774. He had been a seaman, schoolmaster, corset maker, and customs officer, and he wasn't successful at anything. But with the help of Ben Franklin, Paine was hired as editor of a Philadelphia magazine. On January 10, 1776, Paine anonymously published a little pamphlet in which he set forth his views on the need for American independence from Britain. He called it Common Sense. This pamphlet was straightforward, clear, and simple in its prose. Basically, it said the king was a brute with no reasonable mandate to rule in Britain, let alone America. That Britain was a leech feeding off the back of American enterprise, and that it was time for the colonies to stand up on their own and become a beacon of freedom for the world. The pamphlet electrified the country. Within a short time, 120,000 copies were sold, and the number eventually rose to a staggering 500,000 copies, or one for every five people in America, including slaves. Paine never made a dime, having patriotically signed over royalties to Congress. It was read by soldiers and politicians alike, and it shifted the emphasis of the fight to a struggle for independence and not just for a new relationship with Britain. Writing history. On June 7, 1776, Congress began to deal with the independence issue in earnest. Virginia delegate Richard Henry Lee prepared a resolution stating the colonies are, and of a right ought to be, free and independent states. A few days later, delegates appointed a committee of five to draft a formal declaration backing Lee's resolution, just in case Congress decided to adopt it. The committee consisted of Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, a Connecticut lawyer named Roger Sherman, a New York iron mine owner named Robert Livingston, and a 33-year-old red-haired lawyer from Virginia named Thomas Jefferson. The committee got on well, although Sherman had a habit of picking his teeth, which provoked Franklin into warning that if he didn't stop, Franklin would play his harmonica. Remember, Jefferson set to work at a portable desk he had designed himself, and a few weeks later, he produced a document that has come to be regarded as one of the most eloquent political statements in human history. True, he exaggerated some of the grievances the colonists had against the king. True, he rather hypocritically declared that all men are created equal, ignoring the fact that he and hundreds of other Americans owned slaves, whom they certainly didn't regard as having been created equal. Overall, though, it was a magnificent document that set forth all the reasons America wanted to go its own way, and why all people who wanted to do the same thing should be allowed to do so. After a bit of tinkering by Franklin, the document was presented to Congress on June 28. See Appendix B for the full text. At the demand of some Southern representatives, a section blaming the king for American slavery was taken out. Then, on July 2, Congress adopted the resolution submitted by Lee. The second day of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch, instant of time, in the history of America, predicted John Adams. He missed it by 2 days because America chose to remember July 4th instead, the day Congress formally adopted the Declaration of Independence, or, as one member put it, Mr. Jefferson's explanation of Mr. Lee's resolution. With independence declared, Congress now had to find a substitute form of government. Starting in August 1776 and continuing into 1777, members finally came up with something they called the Articles of Confederation. Basically, it called for a weak central government with a virtually powerless president and Congress. the power to do most key things, such as impose taxes, was left to the states. Even so, it took the states until 1781 to finish ratifying the Articles, so reluctant were they to give up any of their power. It was a poor excuse for a new government, but it was a start. In the meantime, the new country was looking for a few foreign friends. Cozying up to the French. Still smarting from its defeats by Britain in a series of wars, France was more than a little happy when war broke out between its archenemy and the American colonies, and almost immediately started sending the rebels supplies and money. By the end of the war, France had provided nearly $20 million in aid of various kinds, and it's estimated as much as 90% of the gunpowder used by the Americans in the first part of the Revolution was supplied or paid for by the French. In December 1776, Congress sent Benjamin Franklin to Paris to see whether he could entice even more aid from the French. Personally, he was a big hit with most of France, especially the ladies. But King Louis XVI wasn't overly impressed. He is reported to have given one of Franklin's lady friends a chamber pot with Franklin's picture on the bottom, and the king took a wait-and-see attitude before committing the country to a more entangling alliance. News of a great American victory in the Battle of Saratoga, however, caused Louis and his ministers to think the rebels just might win. On February 6, 1778, France formally recognized America as an independent nation and agreed to a military alliance. Two different fleets and thousands of French soldiers were sent to the war and played key roles in the deciding battles. The French entry also caused Britain to have to worry about being invaded by a French army and about having to fight the French navy in the West Indies, or wherever else they encountered it. Undergoing life changes, the Loyalists and the slaves. Before I get to who fought whom, where, and how it all came about, it's worth taking a look at the war's impact on two very different parts of the American population, the Loyalists and the slaves. Remaining loyal to the crown. Slightly less than one of every three white colonists didn't side with the Revolution and remained loyal to the crown. Many, but by no means all, were from the aristocracy or had jobs they owed to the British government. Some of these Loyalists, or Tories as they were also called, kept quiet about their allegiances, but many acted as spies or guides for the British forces. As many as 30,000 actually fought against their rebel neighbors, and some battles were purely American versus American affairs. One of the Tories, Banastre Tarleton, rose to a major command in the British Army and was feared and hated for his savagery and reputation for executing prisoners. In some areas, such as New York City and parts of North and South Carolina, Loyalists were dominant, but in areas where they weren't, they paid a heavy price for their loyalty. Their taxes were sometimes doubled, their property trashed, and their businesses shunned. When the war ended, things got even worse. A new verse was added to Yankee Doodle by victorious rebels. Now, Tories, all what can you say? Come, is this not a griper? That while your hopes are drained away, 'tis you must pay the piper. Tory property was confiscated, and as many as 80,000 Loyalists eventually left America for Canada, England, and the West Indies. Confronting slavery issues. One of the thorniest and most embarrassing problems Congress was confronted with during the Revolutionary War was what to do about slaves. At first, Congress declared that no Africans, freed or not, could fight in the Continental Army. But when Washington pointed out that they might end up fighting for the British, who were offering freedom in exchange for fighting the rebels, Congress relented and allowed freed slaves to enlist. More than a few American leaders were also red-faced about fighting for freedom while owning slaves, a hypocrisy not lost on their critics. In the end, some slaves fought for the American cause, and some fled to the British side. The issue of slavery, meanwhile, grew as a divisive issue between North and South. In most of the northern states during the war, the slave trade was outlawed. In the South, the number of slaves actually grew, mostly because of the birth rates among slaves already there. And slavery spread as Southerners moved west into Kentucky and Tennessee. Winning a war. Okay, here's pretty much how the actual fighting unfolded. The Americans started off pretty promisingly, winning an early battle in New York and holding their own at a big battle outside Boston, mostly because the British were slow to recognize they had a real war on their hands. But then, the Americans launched an invasion of Canada, which proved to be a really bad idea. Shortly after the Canada failure, Washington got his tail kicked in New York and escaped total disaster only through great luck. But Washington learned a valuable lesson. He couldn't possibly win by fighting the British in a series of open-field, European-style major battles. The trick, the Continental Army learned, was to be a moving target. "We fight, get beat, rise and fight again," noted General Nathaniel Greene. Washington did win a couple of smaller victories, which were great for morale, but he also suffered through a couple of hideous winters at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and Morristown, New Jersey, which were bad for morale. But the British made a series of tactical blunders and lost an entire army in upstate New York. Then they turned their attentions to the South, made more blunders, and lost another entire army in Virginia. Having apparently run out of mistakes, they quit, and America won. Filling a British fort. Less than a month after Lexington and Concord, American troops under Vermont frontiersman Ethan Allen surprised and captured a British fort, Fort Ticonderoga, on the shores of Lake Champlain in New York. They captured 60 cannons and mortars, which they eventually used to drive the British out of Boston. The victory was a big confidence booster. Battling over Bunker, Breed's Hill. This battle, on June 17, 1775, was actually fought on Breed's Hill, which is next to Bunker Hill, just outside Boston. About 1,400 Americans held the hill. About 2,500 British troops attacked them in a frontal assault, rather than by surrounding them. The Brits won after two charges, but they paid a heavy toll. About 1,000, or 40% of their troops, were killed or wounded, while the Americans suffered about 400 killed or wounded. The carnage shook British Commander William Howe so much, he became overly cautious and conservative in future battles. Losing the campaign in Canada. In late 1775, American leaders Richard Montgomery and Benedict Arnold launched an invasion of Canada. The Yanks thought the Canadians wouldn't put up much of a fight. Bad thought. Americans lost battles at Quebec and Montreal and were forced to retreat. The losses left Canada firmly in British hands and gave the Brits a good base from which to launch attacks on New York and New England. Nixing plans to take New York. In mid-1776, Washington and his entire army of about 18,000 men moved to the area around New York City, hoping to hem in and defeat a British army of about 25,000. But many of the American troops were raw recruits, who panicked and ran in a series of battles in the area. By the fall, it was Washington who was nearly trapped. Under protection of a heavy fog that materialized at just the right time, the American army slipped away into New Jersey and then to Pennsylvania. It was a major defeat for the American army, but it could have been a lot worse. Winning at Trenton and Princeton. Smarting from about 6 months of running away, Washington moved his army across the ice-choked Delaware River on Christmas Eve 1776 and surprised a Hessian brigade in Trenton, New Jersey. The result was that Washington captured more than 900 Hessian troops and 1,200 weapons without losing a single man. Washington then followed up with a victory over the British a few days later at Princeton, New Jersey. The victories were smashing morale boosters for the Yanks. Making the Brits surrender at Saratoga. In 1777, British gentleman Johnny Burgoyne proposed to lead a British army into New York and New England from Canada, while the British army already in New York City sailed down to capture Philadelphia. It turned out to be a disaster for the Brits. Burgoyne had no concept of a march through enemy-infested wilderness and took along officers' wives and children. Continually harassed by American troops and running low on food and supplies, Burgoyne's army lost two battles near Saratoga. On October 17, 1777, the British army of nearly 6,000 men surrendered. News of the victory helped convince France to enter the war on the American side. Sparring at sea. On September 23, 1779, an American Navy ship named the Bonhomme Richard took on the British warship Serapis off the coast of England. The American captain, John Paul Jones, saw two of his major guns explode on the first discharge. Undismayed, he pulled alongside the Serapis, and the two ships pounded each other for more than 2 hours. At one point, when asked if he would surrender, Jones replied, "I have not yet begun to fight." Finally, faced with the arrival of another American ship, the Serapis surrendered. Jones's own ship was so badly damaged it had to be abandoned, and he transferred his flag to the British ship. But the victory was the greatest single naval feat of the war and shook British confidence in its navy. Losing big in Charleston. This was the worst American defeat of the war. In the spring of 1780, about 8,500 British and Loyalist troops and 14 ships surrounded the city of Charleston, South Carolina, trapping an American army under the command of General Benjamin Lincoln. On May 12th, Lincoln surrendered his entire army of 5,500 men, along with huge amounts of weapons. Minimizing a loss at Guilford Courthouse. Most of the war in the South consisted of British troops beating American troops, chasing them, and then beating them again. In December 1780, Congress finally put a competent general in charge of the American forces in the South while Washington fought in the North. He was 38-year-old Nathanael Greene, who was probably the only American general to consistently outstrategize his opponents. After victories at the battles of Cowpens and Eutaw Springs, Greene faced British General Charles Cornwallis at Guilford Courthouse in North Carolina. The British won what was one of the bloodiest and most bitter battles of the war, but they suffered almost 30% casualties, while Greene's losses were light. Cornwallis was forced to withdraw out of the Carolinas and back to Virginia, taking his troops to Yorktown. Turning things around at Yorktown. After trying for months to coordinate his own troops with the French troops and ships that were supposedly ready to aid the American cause, Washington finally hooked up with his allies in May 1781. Together with two French fleets, French and American armies converged on Yorktown and hemmed in the British army under Cornwallis. The British, meanwhile, mishandled two fleets of their own and were unable to come to Cornwallis's rescue. On October 19, 1781, Cornwallis surrendered his entire army of 8,000 men. The British band played a tune called "The World Turned Upside Down," and the band hired by the French played "Yankee Doodle." In London, when Lord North, the British Prime Minister, heard the news, he cried out, "Oh God, it is all over!" Actually, it wasn't over for more than a year. The British army still held New York, and there were some small battles until the formal peace treaty was signed on February 3, 1783. The British were gracious losers, mainly because they wanted to drive a wedge between America and France. They gave up rights to all the land from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi River and from Canada to Florida, which was far more than the Americans actually controlled. The Americans promised to treat the Loyalists in their midst fairly and set up fair rules so that British creditors could collect pre-war debts. Neither promise was kept. American independence was won. The question now was what to do with it. Chapter 6. Blueprints and Birth Pains, 1783-1800. In this chapter, bringing order to the colonies, electing the first president, establishing an economy, increasing troubles at home and overseas. After winning its independence from Britain, America felt a little like a kid who has just moved out of his parents' house and isn't sure what step comes next in growing up. The country had no real government, no sound financing system, and no true foreign friends. Fortunately, it did have a group of extraordinary individuals, some of whom had helped lead it through the Revolution, who were willing to try to find a form of government that would fit. Putting aside most of their personal differences and aspirations, at least at first, they came up with a system of governing the new country that became a true wonder of the world. Making the rules. America limped through the Revolutionary War, guided by the Continental Congress, a group of men selected by colonial legislatures. The Congress, in turn, came up with something called the Articles of Confederation. Drafted in 1777, but not ratified by all the states until 1781, the Articles were based on the idea that the individual states would be friendly with one another and cooperate when it was in their mutual interest. Each state had one vote in the Congress, and it took 9 of the 13 states to ratify any decision. Congress ran matters of war and peace, operated the post office, coined money, and dealt with Native Americans when the states didn't want to. It had no power to tax or to establish a federal judicial system, and it lacked any real power to make the individual states pay attention to its legal authority to make postal, coin, or war and peace decisions. It wasn't an awful system, but it guaranteed a continual stream of squabbles among the states. Making things worse were schemes by agents of Spain, France, and Britain. They tried to get Americans who lived in the western parts of the new country to break away. War hero Ethan Allen, for example, met with British agents to discuss making his beloved Vermont a British province and narrowly escaped being tried for treason. Remember, still, at least two good bits of legislation came out of the loose-knit Confederation. The first was the Land Ordinance of 1785, which set up the way land owned by the federal government, which basically was territory won from Britain that wasn't claimed by one of the states, would be divided and sold. The ordinance called for the land to be surveyed into square townships, which were 6 miles on each side. Each township was then surveyed into 36 areas of 1 square mile each, 640 acres. The parcels were then listed for sale at public auction and could, in turn, be subdivided by the owner into smaller parcels for sale. Part of the revenue went to the establishment of public schools. The second piece of legislation was enacted in 1787. Called the Northwest Ordinance, it stated that as new states were admitted to the country, they would be equal in every way to the original 13. It also banned slavery in the new territories, although this was later changed. Both laws were good starts to stabilizing the new country, but ongoing troubles in trying to regulate commerce among the states and in trying to raise money for the federal government still plagued the nation, especially because every state had its own currency and assigned it its own value. Going back to Philly. By 1787, it was apparent to many leaders that the Articles of Confederation needed an overhaul, or the Union of States would eventually fall apart. So Congress agreed to call a convention of delegates from each state to try to fix things. The first of the delegates, selected by state legislatures to arrive in Philadelphia in May 1787, was James Madison, a 36-year-old scholar and politician from Virginia who was so frail he couldn't serve in the army during the Revolution. Madison had so many ideas on how to fix things, he couldn't wait to get started. Not everyone else was in such a hurry. Although the convention was supposed to begin May 15th, it wasn't until May 25th that enough of the delegates chosen by the state legislatures showed up to have a quorum. Rhode Island never did send anyone. Eventually, 55 delegates took part. Notable by their absence were some of the leading figures of the recent rebellion against England. Thomas Jefferson was in France. Thomas Paine was in England. Sam Adams and John Hancock weren't selected to go, and Patrick Henry refused. But those who did show up were hardy second stringers. George Washington was there and was unanimously selected the convention's president. Benjamin Franklin, at 81, the oldest delegate, was there. But Madison and a handsome 32-year-old, self-made success story from New York named Alexander Hamilton were the true stars of the group. Half of the group's members were lawyers, and 29 were college-educated. Many were wealthy, and thus had a bigger-than-most stake in straightening out the country's financial mess. Their average age was 42. They met in long and highly secret sessions, with armed guards at the doors. Their reasoning was that their task was so difficult that any leaks about what they were doing would only increase outside pressures. They studied other forms of government. They debated. And after 17 weeks, on September 17, 1787, they voted 39-3, with 13 absent, to approve a 10-page document that became the United States Constitution. Then, most of them adjourned to a local tavern and hoisted a few. Remember, the document the delegates created was a masterpiece of compromises. Big states gained more clout when it was decided that representation in the House of Representatives would be based on population, while small states got protection from being bullied when it was decided that each state would have the same number of members, 2, in the Senate. The South won the right to count slaves as 3/5 of a person when determining population for representation in the House. The North got a promise that the slave trade would end for good in 1807. Actually, the South didn't mind this compromise all that much because it didn't mean slavery itself would end, just the practice of importing more slaves from overseas. In fact, it ensured that the value of slaves already here would increase, thus making their owners richer. The Constitution gave Congress the power to regulate commerce among states as well as with foreign nations, and to pass laws with a simple majority of its members. It gave the presidency a powerful role. It created a federal judicial system, with the Supreme Court at the top, and it left the individual states with a fair amount of independence to make their own laws on most matters. No one thought it was perfect, but most of the delegates thought it was a pretty good blueprint from which to build. While the last members of the convention were signing the document, Franklin pointed to a sun painted on the chair in which Washington was sitting. "I have often looked at that behind the president, without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting," he said. "But now, at length, I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." But they still had to sell the blueprint to the rest of the country. Stand up and be heard. A standing army is like an erect penis, an excellent assurance of domestic tranquility, but a dangerous temptation to foreign adventure. Elbridge Gerry, a convention delegate from Massachusetts, arguing against a provision that would allow for a full-time military organization. Selling the Constitution to the States. The convention submitted its work to the Congress that was still laboring under the old Articles of Confederation, and Congress accepted it after 3 days of sometimes intense debate. But because of the enormity of the issue, Congress also didn't want to be totally responsible if things went wrong, proving that some things never change. So Congress sent the proposal to the states for ratification. Each state had to elect delegates who would consider the proposed constitution, and when 9 states had approved it, it would become the law of the land. It was a gamble, because if any of the big states, Virginia, New York, Massachusetts, or Pennsylvania, rejected it and went its own way, the whole deal might fall apart. In addition, a lot of people who hadn't thought much about the need for a central government, which was probably the majority of Americans, weren't sold on the idea at all. But the idea of letting ordinary people have a say, actually about 1/4 of the population was eligible to vote, led to a great deal of spirited debate on the subject, which allowed pro-Constitution forces a chance to make their case. They did. In a brilliant series of 85 newspaper essays that became known as the Federalist Papers, Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay argued eloquently for adoption of the Constitution. Much more important was the public support of the two most popular men in America, Franklin and Washington. Anti-Constitution forces also made powerful public arguments, but their efforts were not as well organized and lacked star appeal. The first 5 states to ratify did so by January 1788. The following month, Massachusetts agreed, but only on the condition that a list of specific individual rights be added to the Constitution as soon as possible. By July, all but North Carolina and Rhode Island had ratified it, and they fell in line by May 1790. "Our Constitution is in actual operation," Franklin wrote, "and everything appears to promise that it will last. But in this world, nothing can be certain but death and taxes." Giving weight to the Bill of Rights. The first 10 amendments to the Constitution were added mainly because a lot of Americans believed in the saying, "Get it in writing." The drafters of the original Constitution didn't spell out specific rights, mainly because they didn't think it was necessary. The document defined the powers of Congress, and thus its creators assumed that everything left over belonged to individuals and the states. But some states insisted the specific rights be spelled out as soon as possible after the Constitution was ratified. So James Madison, at the urging of Thomas Jefferson, came up with a list of 12 amendments, only 10 of which were ratified by 11 of the states in 1791. The 2 amendments left out had to do with the number of members of the House of Representatives and prohibiting Congress from setting its own salaries. For some reason, Connecticut and Georgia didn't get around to ratifying the remaining 10 until 1941. See Appendix A for the list of the 10 amendments that made it. Dishing up politics, American style. Now that it had rules, America needed a president, and the choice was a no-brainer. George Washington was unanimously elected in April 1789 by the Electoral College, which had been established by the Constitution and was composed of men elected either by popular vote or by state legislatures. Washington set out from his home in Virginia for the temporary capital at New York, which soon moved to Philadelphia, where it stayed until the federal district that is now Washington, D.C. was completed in 1800. Everywhere he went, Washington was greeted by parades and cheering crowds. Washington the Politician. Washington wasn't a great politician, although he did know enough to buy 47 gallons of beer, 35 gallons of wine, and 3 barrels of rum for potential voters in his first campaign for the Virginia legislature. He wasn't a good public speaker, and he wasn't a great innovator. But he was perfect for the new country. He was enormously popular with the public, even those who didn't like his policies. Because of that, other political leaders were wise to defer to him, at least publicly. Behind his back, John Adams referred to Washington as Old Muttonhead, and Alexander Hamilton called him the Great Booby. Washington was also good at assembling competent people around him and playing to their strengths while ignoring their faults. And he assembled a heck of a group. Adams was his vice president. Hamilton was his treasurer. Thomas Jefferson, his secretary of state. Old Revolutionary War buddy Henry Knox, his secretary of war. And sharp-tongued Edmund Randolph of Virginia, his attorney general. Family feuding. Jefferson versus Hamilton. But Washington's cabinet wasn't exactly one big happy family. For example, Hamilton and Adams disliked each other even though they shared many of the same political views. Adams once referred to Hamilton as the bastard brat of a Scotch peddler. And Jefferson and Hamilton not only disagreed politically, they were different in a host of other ways. Hamilton was short, but impeccable in his dress and manners. Jefferson was tall and often looked like an unmade bed. Hamilton grew up poor in New York and was illegitimate. Jefferson grew up wealthy in a leading family in Virginia. Hamilton had a deeply abiding distrust of the common man and a deep affection for wealth. Jefferson disliked the upper classes and professed that the farmer was nature's greatest creation. Although Jefferson was a relatively pleasant guy to be around, Hamilton could be arrogant and snotty. Given their differences, it shouldn't be surprising that the two men were at opposite ends of the political spectrum. And given their abilities and stature, it shouldn't be surprising that people who thought the same way began to form political parties around them. At the time, most politicians repudiated the idea of political parties, at least publicly. "If I could not go to heaven but with a political party," Jefferson said, "I would not go at all." But people being people, the formation of parties revolving around a certain philosophy of governing was probably inevitable. Remember, the Hamiltonians were called Federalists. In essence, they supported a strong central government, a powerful central bank, government support of business, and a loose interpretation of the Constitution, and restrictions on public speech and the press. They opposed the expansion of democratic elections and were generally pro-British when it came to foreign affairs. "Those who own the country," said Federalist John Jay, "ought to govern it." The Jeffersonians were first called Democratic Republicans, than just Republicans. They favored more power to individual states and state-chartered banks, no special favors for business, a strict reading of the Constitution, giving more people the vote and relatively free speech and a free press. They were generally pro-French. It's too simplistic to say today's Republicans are yesterday's Federalists and today's Democrats are descended from Jefferson's party. Hamilton, for example, supported big federal government programs, which today would make him more of a Democrat, while Jefferson wanted to minimize government, which sounds like the modern Republican. But the dominance of just two parties, Federalists and Republicans, foreshadowed the two-party system that America has pretty much stuck with throughout its history. By 1796, Washington had had enough of fathering a country. He declined a third term and went home to his plantation in Mount Vernon, Virginia. Hamilton, who was born in St. Croix and therefore under the Constitution couldn't be president, hoped someone he could control would be elected. He backed Thomas Pinckney of South Carolina, who was Washington's minister to England. But Vice President John Adams, whom Hamilton disdained, won. Jefferson was the Republican candidate, and because he came in second, he became vice president, per the Constitution. It soon became clear that this wasn't a great idea. So in 1804, the states amended the Constitution to allow candidates to run for either president or vice president, but not both. Raising the dough. Every successful country needs a sound financial plan, and it fell to Hamilton to devise one for America. The first thing he had to do was establish the new nation's credit. To do that, he needed to clean up its existing debts, such as the $54 million the federal government owed foreign and domestic creditors. Hamilton proposed the debt be paid off in full, rather than at a discount as creditors had feared. Hamilton argued that if America didn't make good on what it already owed, no one would want to lend it money in the future. In addition, he proposed that the federal government also pay off about $21 million in debts the individual states had run up. The old debts would be paid off by issuing bonds. But states like Virginia, which had paid off much of its Revolutionary War debts, were peeved at the thought of the federal government picking up other states' tabs and then sticking all U.S. residents with the bill. So they engaged in a little horse trading. Virginia withdrew its objections to the plan, and in return, Hamilton and the Washington administration agreed to locate the new federal district next door to Virginia on the Potomac. Whatever advantage Virginia thought that would give it has certainly evaporated by now. Many members of Congress supported Hamilton's plan to pay off the debts dollar for dollar, especially because many of them either held the old bonds or had snapped them up for next to nothing and stood to make enormous profits. Hamilton himself was accused of using his office to make money off the bonds, but if he was guilty, he didn't do a very good job because he died broke. To raise money to pay off the bonds, the federal government established taxes, called tariffs, on goods imported into America. It also slapped a tax of 7 cents a gallon on whiskey, which was pretty steep considering whiskey in many of the southern and western states sold for only 25 cents a gallon. Finally, Hamilton proposed a nationally chartered bank that would print paper money backed by the federal government, and in which the government would be the minority stockholder and deposit its revenues. To be located in Philadelphia, the bank would be chartered for 21 years. Jefferson howled that the whole idea would cripple state banks and was unconstitutional. But Hamilton, with the backing of Washington, prevailed. The bank's stock sold out within 4 hours after going on sale. Hamilton's plan worked, in large part because the American economy kicked into high gear in the 1790s. Another war between France and England helped increase America's share of the world market. Trade in the West Indies that had been stunted by the Revolutionary War was revived, and industry, particularly in the North, began to develop. America, the new kid on the block, now had some change in its pockets. Earning respect. A government is only as good as the respect it commands from its citizens, and respect for the new U.S. government wasn't universal. Whiskey makers, former soldiers, Native Americans, and people who thought some politicians were jerks, and said so publicly, were among the groups whose respect the new government had to earn. Shaking things up, Shays' Rebellion. Daniel Shays was a Massachusetts farmer and Revolutionary War veteran who, like many of his fellow vets, found himself broke and in debt after the war. Moreover, the Constitution Massachusetts adopted in 1780 was drafted mostly by businessmen who lived along the coast, and the state's inland farmers got the short end of the stick when it came to things like paying taxes. When taxes couldn't be paid, homes, farms, livestock, and personal possessions were seized, and debtors were sometimes thrown into prison. So in 1786, Shays found himself at the head of an army of about 1,000 men who were fed up. They marched on Springfield, forced the state Supreme Court to flee, and paraded around town. In January 1787, Shays' group tried to take a military arsenal at Springfield. But the state militia routed them, and after a few weeks of skirmishing, they dispersed and abandoned the fight. Several of the group's members were hanged. Shays fled to Vermont and was eventually pardoned, but he died the next year. The whole thing wasn't in vain, however. Some of the reforms they wanted, such as lower court costs, an exemption on workmen's tools from debt seizures, and changes in the tax laws, were adopted. Jefferson noted, "A little rebellion now and then is a good thing. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." Washington, however, despaired that the rebellion illustrated how too much democracy would lead to anarchy. The biggest impact of Shays' rebellion may have been that it helped convince some of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention that the country needed a strong central government to handle such things. Taxing liquid corn, the Whiskey Rebellion. This is how important whiskey was on the American frontier. Americans often used it in place of cash for commercial transactions. It was also the cheapest way to market some of the surplus corn crop. So it's easy to understand why people got upset when the new federal government announced it was slapping what amounted to a 25% tax on the drink. Distillers in western Pennsylvania organized a revolt in 1794, roughing up tax collectors and threatening distilleries that tried to pay the tax. When the state's governor refused to intervene for fear of losing votes, President Washington himself led a massive force of about 13,000 men, a larger army than he had during most of the Revolutionary War, and the rebels scattered. The short-lived rebellion didn't amount to much, but it provided an early test of the federal government's willingness to enforce federal laws. Going mad over the Native Americans. Despite their loss in the Revolution and subsequent peace treaty, the British still had a string of forts in the American Northwest, which was then defined as the area northwest of the Ohio River, east of the Mississippi, and south of the Great Lakes. The Brits said they were there to protect their interests in Canada, but many Americans suspected they were there to stir up the Native Americans. In 1791, a U.S. Army of about 2,000 troops under General Arthur St. Clair marched into what is now Indiana to counter the British Native American threat. But St. Clair was surprised and routed by a Native American force, and he suffered nearly 50% casualties. In 1793, another force of 2,000 troops tried again, this time led by General Mad Anthony Wayne. A Revolutionary War hero, Wayne got his nickname not from being nuts, but from being daring and a bit reckless in battle, which may be the same thing. Anyway, in August 1794, Wayne's troops attacked a Native American force of about the same size at a site called Fallen Timbers in Indiana. Wayne's army rolled over the Native Americans, burning their villages and destroying their crops. The victory ended the Native American threat and restored much confidence in the U.S. Army. Attempting to censor the press. American newspapers had been used as a political weapon almost as long as there had been American newspapers. But the rise of the two-party system in the 1790s greatly increased their use and their sting. Pro-Jefferson editors, such as Philip Freneau and Benjamin Bache, squared off against pro-Hamilton scribes, such as John Fineau and William Cobbett. These were nasty fellows with a quill in their hands. Bache once wrote that, "If ever a nation was debauched by a man, the American nation has been debauched by Washington," and Cobbett opined that America would be truly free only when Jefferson's head will be rotting cheek to jowl with that of some toil-killed Negro slave. By 1798, the Federalist-controlled Congress had had enough. It narrowly approved the Alien and Sedition Acts. The acts extended the naturalization period from 5 to 14 years to keep out the foreign riffraff, and Congress also made it a crime to publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing about the President, Congress, or the government in general. Hundreds were indicted under the Sedition Act, but only 10, all of them Republicans, were convicted. Among them was Congressman Matthew Lyon of Vermont, who had already gained notoriety by spitting in the face of Federalist Congressman Roger Griswold on the floor of Congress. Lyon was sentenced to 4 months in jail for writing about President Adams' unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice. Lyon was re-elected to Congress while in jail. Partly because its application was so one-sided, the Sedition Act's popularity quickly waned, and in the end, probably hurt the Federalist cause much more than it helped. The act expired on March 3, 1801, a day before Republican Jefferson assumed the presidency. It wasn't renewed, and American politicians in both camps decided it was generally better to develop a thick hide when it came to the press than to try to slap a muzzle on the First Amendment. Finding foreign friction. Most Americans applauded when the French Revolution, which eventually overthrew the French monarchy and did away with the feudalistic system of government ruled by an aristocracy, began in 1789. Americans even continued to support it after the revolution was usurped by radical rebels, who turned it into the Reign of Terror. Thousands of French aristocrats, including King Louis XVI, had their heads lopped off by the guillotine. But many Americans shrugged off the excesses and focused on the French revolutionaries' goals of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, French for liberty, equality, and brotherhood. Remember, but when the revolt spread to once again engulf Europe in war, more sober Americans started to worry. The Federalists, led by Hamilton, didn't want to take the French side against the British. For one thing, they detested the excesses of the French mobocracy, or mob rule. For another, they realized that England was America's best customer, and most of the revenues from tariffs paid on imports came from English ships. The Jefferson-led Republicans, on the other hand, didn't want to side with the British. They reasoned that the French had backed them in their revolution, so they should do the same. But America's first two presidents, Washington and Adams, didn't want to side with anyone. Both men saw that the longer America stayed out of the European mess, the stronger the country would become, and thus the more able it would be to control its own destiny rather than rely on the fortunes of an alliance. Staying neutral wasn't easy. British naval ships routinely stopped American merchant ships and forced American sailors into service aboard British ships, a practice called impressments. French ships also attacked American merchants with England-bound cargoes. But luck and skillful negotiating kept America out of the Anglo-Franco fracas for a generation. In 1794, Washington sent diplomat John Jay to England. Jay eventually negotiated a treaty with the British in which the British agreed to give up their forts in the American Northwest and pay for damages caused by seizures of American ships. But the British didn't agree to stop impressing American sailors, and Jay agreed the United States would repay pre-Revolutionary War debts it still owed. The Jay Treaty was greeted with widespread howls of rage in America, but it cooled things down with the British for more than a decade. John Jay. John Jay was not your average revolutionary. Jay was born into a wealthy New York family in 1745. He became a lawyer and developed a lucrative law practice, hobnobbing with New York's very pro-British aristocracy. But during the Revolution and afterward, Jay became one of the busiest of America's statesmen. Over the course of his career, he served in both Continental Congresses, was Chief Justice of the New York Supreme Court, helped negotiate the peace treaty with the British in 1783, brokered the 1794 treaty with Britain that avoided another war, was the first Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, served as America's first Foreign Secretary before cabinet posts were created, was New York governor for two terms, and helped abolish slavery in that state. Although an ardent Federalist, Jay was highly regarded by leaders of both parties for his intelligence, diplomatic skills, and willingness to take the heat on unpopular decisions. But his most remarkable accomplishment may have been this. He did all these things and